Funding for THINK comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens when a single mother and her only child approach the first time in their shared history when they will live independent lives? For Cam Lightsey and her daughter Aubrey, that inevitable moment of separation brings with it surprising conflict, as Aubrey suddenly bristles against the intervention of a mother to whom she has been unusually bonded to, and explores a secret relationship with the long-absent father she has known only through photographs and news clippings. The resulting story by Texas author Sarah Bird is at once poignant and very, very funny for readers who see the story unfold in dual diary entries by a mother and daughter navigating uncharted territory with no clear vision of where their relationship will be when the journey is complete. Sarah Bird is a novelist and also a columnist for Texas Monthly. Her new book is called The Gap Year. You can meet her in person tonight at a Real bookstore in Fairview, Texas. Drinks will be served at 6, and the book signing begins at 7. Sarah, welcome to THINK.
Well, Chris, I'm delighted to be here.
So in this case, gap year, everybody knows what that means. It's taking a year between high school and college. But it really, that phrase is very much fraught with meaning in this case.
Yes. The gap year, obviously refers to the time after high school when the student may or may not be ready to go on to college, and you do something like, you know, build a pump station in Ethiopia or work on an organic farm or something like this. In this case, it's not quite that. Many, many, many surprises for the mom and the daughter, just as there were many, many surprises for me.
Mm-hmm. When we first, I love the scene when we first meet the mom, Cam. She's swimming, and all she can do, her daughter is days away from turning 18 and ostensibly leaving for school, and all she can do is obsess about what she should have done, starting from the time that her daughter was in diapers.
See, that came out of my experience. Our son, in 2008, was part of the largest freshman class ever to enter. Was it almost 3 million kids, and everything about the process surprised me, just completely blindsided me, including time travel.
Did you think you were ready before?
I completely thought I was ready because I assumed that because I was not one of those moms who had baked her total identity into the homeroom cupcakes, and I had a rich, full life independent of my child, I didn't think there would be anything to it. I thought it would be kind of like a vacation from you know, some of the less pleasant aspects of getting an adolescent boy out the door. Not so. I was really blindsided by grief is really the only word for it, and the different forms it took, such as time travel. So I gave that to my character because as the moment approached where he was going to leave, I just kept revisiting our entire history and thinking, oh gosh, if we would have lived in this neighborhood, then he could have ridden his bike all over and he would have had different friends. And I don't know what I was trying to do to sort of make the story turn out differently, in which he didn't leave or something. I don't know. And I would go online to consult my guru, Sri Googlenami, about this odd phenomenon. So I'd type in empty nest, try to type in empty nest, and always came out empty next. My little finger, my ring finger, would keep hitting the wrong letter, and it sort of felt that way to me.
Yeah, it was scary for me to read it. My kids are in elementary and middle school because I sort of feel like I'll be prepared when the time comes. There's part of me that thinks it's great.
Chris, you will be. That's my promise. That's my promise to all moms.
I guess eventually you have to be ready. Right?
But you know what surprised me about this is I approach life by over-researching everything. That's just who I am. I just am confident, getting all the facts at my fingertips. I'm a proud member of the fact-based community. Facts, facts, facts. So every step of our son's childhood, really from the moment of conception, I researched. I knew what to expect when I was expecting. I knew what to expect in the toddler years. All those stages, you know, there's lots and lots of material. But then you come to this, and I felt like I just dropped off the edge of the map into this terra incognita that I didn't understand. I didn't understand what was happening. And as I said, I would go online to try to find ways to understand it. And mostly, I found, oh, yay, the kid's out of the house, and now our lives are our own, and we can travel whenever we want, have sex whenever we want, and mostly this feeling of being chastised for being sad about your child leaving, mm-hmm. about understanding that that's the end of his childhood and the end of your active time as a mom.
Well, they probably wouldn't call it empty nest syndrome if everybody didn't at some point understand that there is a loss there. You know, they don't call it free spare room syndrome or whatever. You know?
Free spare room syndrome. Yes. Right. I think, you know, that has to do with the sort of looking backwards when children were a woman's entire life and how we do not want to return to that point.
Well, the other delicious detail that you give to Cam, the mother, is that she is a lactation consultant. So
yes.
All day long at work,
yes.
She is with people who are at the very beginning of this journey of parenthood and of
right.
responsibility for their kids. And at the time at which their children, literally 24 hours a day, rely on them simply to survive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That was a huge gift to me that I made a friend, Chris Kovac, and I acknowledge her in the book. She's a lactation consultant, one of the funniest, most wonderful humans I've ever met. And she did me the great honor of allowing me to come with her to her classes, her breastfeeding classes, and go with her on her rounds to visit new mothers right out of delivery with their new babies. And I was so impressed by the world and by the level of intimacy she achieved just walking in the door, talking to these new mothers. And how much life you connect with so immediately. So that was fantastic. And I hadn't expected it to be as important in the book as it turned out to be.
No, I think it's wonderful. And I love that you describe on multiple occasions the idea that, you know, people just hear her voice on the phone and they're like, oh, thank God you called.
Yes.
And she knows exactly what to tell them. And mm-hmm, she doesn't mm-hmm. quite know what to do for herself and her daughter and her life as it's changing.
I know. Our own lives are so much harder. We're our own cobbler's children, I guess. Yes. And you know, you can, mothers still come up to me after moms whose kids have long gone and you know, practically get tears in their eyes talking about how much they related to the travails of breastfeeding. It's an emotional topic. Interestingly enough, the great torture that the digital age has bestowed upon writers are the Amazon reviews. And so I've gotten to read some opinions about way too much about lactation consulting. You'll never look at nipples the same again. And, you know, not to characterize, but these are written by men. It's a huge subject, and it's a huge, the first gigantic physical connection. But throughout the book, it's so much about physical connections, which is why I used the quote from the Auden poem at the beginning about
for our beautiful children.
But in my arms till break of day, let the living creatures lie, mortal, guilty, but to me, the entirely beautiful. Mm. And I think that's so lovely. And although Auden is speaking, celebrating his homosexual lover, it's also so much about visceral physical love, which defines motherhood. And then the visceral physical love that mothers can't control, which is who their daughters fall in love with.
And that's another interesting element here, because Aubrey, who is a kid who seems to have everything going for her, she's been very dutiful and not much trouble all this time, surprises even herself with her choice of boyfriends. But he's not, we know from the beginning that he's not a bad kid. He's just, nobody could be good enough, it seems like, for one's child.
I know. I used to tease my mom when she expressed disapproval of the guys I went out with. And I said, come on, face it, Mom. The only person you'd be happy with is some diplomat, some superhuman.
Yeah.
That's exact. But in the case of Aubrey, I think in the case of many dutiful girls of that age, you're just waiting for the door to open.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the door that's going to take you as far from who you are, which is as far from mom as you can get. And that's the door that opened for her. And she was just ready to walk through it.
And we do have this sense that the closer a mother and child are throughout childhood, the harder it is when that break inevitably comes.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, it was true for me. I adored my mother, and then I said horrible things to her, and then I adored her again.
It always strikes me as funny how much better I understand my parents now that I am a parent.
Yes.
And their lives would have been so much easier had I had this insight before, you know, I was in my 30s and 40s.
Indeed. Indeed, that gift.
The other element we have in this book is Cam's best friend, Dory, who has a daughter about the same age, and they're very close and very honest with one another to a point. But there's also the sense that Dory's daughter represents everything that Cam is afraid of happening to Aubrey.
Yes, and Cam sort of beats up on herself because she recognizes that Dory's daughter, Twyla, is her at least. And she said all mothers need an at least, and that's no matter where your child is, at least she's not pregnant. At least she's not on drugs. At least she's not X, Y, and Z. And so there are the levels you can go down to. At least she's not homeless and living on the street. And that's who Twyla is for Cam.
I read that and I had to cringe a little bit guiltily because I recognize that I've done that too. And I'm sure people do that with my kids. You know, at least they're not doing what Chris Boyd's kids are doing. You know,
that aspect of motherhood has surprised me. And it really, really surprised me when we, the run up to going away to colleges. This kind of naked competitiveness, which really everything came off when college started, and parents seem unable to recognize when they're bragging about their children that they're bragging about themselves, and not realizing not everybody's child is going to be going down the golden path. Let's just accept that. But that shocked me to find out kind of that it's sort of a referendum on you as a parent, where your child ends up going to college. Are you a five-star Ivy League parent? Are you, one of the
safety
better...
school parent?
Are you one of the base, one of the better Giant State University sort of parents? Are you a, selective small liberal arts college? See, look, you're looking at me like, God, do I have to learn this? Yes, you do. Yes, you do. See, my other delusion about this was that our son would go to the University of Texas, as I had done, but then come to find out, yes, if he has a 4-point grade average and maybe he has a particle accelerator that he built himself in the basement. Maybe did
in third
little,
grade.
maybe did a little work on the Dead Sea Scrolls, plays several ancient instruments that he built himself. So, once University of Texas was off the table, then I realized that there are 4,000. I got into research mode. There are 4,000 colleges and universities, and it became my job to parse every one of them.
That's a big job to take on.
It's a humongous job, but then it's so emotional because all the other parents are doing this, and they're talking about safety schools and reach schools and. The level of anxiety just gets insane.
My guest this hour is Texas novelist and columnist Sarah Bird. Her new book is called The Gap Year. She's in town to appear tonight at a Real bookstore in Fairview, Texas. The event is called Fierce Words and Stiff Drinks. The stiff drinks start at 6. The signing begins at 7. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd love to hear from you now. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Texas Monthly columnist and novelist Sarah Bird. Her new book is called The Gap Year. She'll appear tonight at a Real bookstore in Fairview. There are drinks at 6 and a signing at 7 o'clock. If you'd like to join the conversation, maybe tell us a bit about your own empty nest experiences. We'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I thought it was interesting in the book that as we read these accounts by mother and daughter, and they're clearly delineated, they're griping about each other. They're sort of perceiving the things about each other that just make them crazy. And they have the exact same sense of humor, maybe separated by 25 years of life experience. But essentially, they really sort of process things in a pretty similar way.
I think humor is very a family culture thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I grew up in a large Irish Catholic family, not uncommon that you riff or die kind
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah.
You've got to hold your own at the dinner table. And mine was a Catholic Air Force family. So there was a fair degree of repression mm-hmm. there. And you could sort of not say anything unless you could get a laugh.
Yeah.
And then you could say anything. So I definitely, you know, see that in families. See that passed down, and it, Aubrey has a different sensibility from Cam, but they, you know, Cam raised her and taught her how to interact. So yeah, makes sense.
It's also interesting that Aubrey, for the first time, sort of tells off a teacher or an authority figure, or at least mm-hmm. says, "I'm not going to do what you're expecting me to do." And at first, she sort of does it accidentally, and then she finds that she likes the feeling.
She likes it. She likes it. She steps outside, and it's exciting. That's what she's looking for: the door to open, the door for her to walk through. She doesn't know who she's going to become, but she knows who she's not going to become. And I think a lot of us can relate to that at that age.
Did you divide your writing days? Did you think, okay, today's going to be a Camden day, today's going to be an Aubrey day, and I need to...
That's funny. I set out, I never had any idea of writing the daughter's point of view. I didn't really, you know, I don't have a daughter, I'm far removed from that age group, and I know so much about the mother's mm-hmm. perspective of this and the difficult separation from an only child. So I started, I wrote that story, and I kept hearing this voice say, "It wasn't exactly that way. Mm-hmm. There's more going on than you think." And I realized that was my voice from when I was a daughter, from when I was trying to find who I was, and I had been dutiful and shy and little grade grubber, and I knew something had to change.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now, and we'll speak with Mary in Fort Worth. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You've had an epiphany for me today. My son has turned 18 the end of May, graduated from high school.
God bless
and
you.
And suddenly has decided that it is, the rules are all of his to make, and he doesn't need to follow any of ours, and has decided to leave home and move out. And I couldn't figure out why I'm bawling so much, and I didn't identify it with mourning. Up until this point, we've been very close, and I didn't identify the mourning portion of that, of him leaving.
I know you're almost not allowed to say that, and you know, I haven't really found much saying, yeah, it's sad. This is a grief period. But I don't see how it can be any other way. I mean, you make such a giant hole in your life for this little creature that you bring into it. And it, as they grow, it keeps growing and your lives become entangled. I mean, we mourn when a dog dies. And then to have your own person leave, I think it's huge and kind of unacknowledged. I'm not... you know, as I say, this empty nest syndrome is scoffed at, but I'm kind of going, if it doesn't exist, I don't know what is happening here, because I was the same way. I was very sad. Our son left and went away to college, and it's the end. And you know, you read on the websites and whatnot, and I said, they'll always come back. My character's reaction, my reaction was, yes, but will they come back as a sweet smelling little newborn? Will they come back as an 8-year-old who holds your hand and looks up adoringly at you? So I acknowledge the sadness of that.
It seems in a way that, you know, mothers of our generation have, I don't know, been sold a bill of goods. But, you know, for our mother's generation, fewer of whom worked outside the home and were
exactly.
expected to be all wrapped up.
Right.
You know, what you described in the beginning of thinking, well, I had a job that I loved and I had a life outside mothering. It's no less an emotional investment
exactly.
than it ever was.
Right. Precisely. Just because you're multitasking and hitting the glass ceiling and whatnot, that's. Those are your emotional anchors. And, you know, as I go back to, it's physical. It's deeply, deeply physical. And I think as mothers, we feel it when they're tiny and, you know, we have this idea, oh, you know, shove them in daycare and carry on your life. And then you realize, no, my physical presence is really all that's going to make them happy. My individual, unique physical presence and smell and everything. And I'm sorry, it's a hard thing to realize, but that continues.
So Cam in the book is a single parent. You're married. Did your husband's responses to your son's leaving play into the perspective that you put into these characters?
Interesting about? Question. I specifically made Cam a single mom with and gave her a daughter instead of a son to put distance between my life and more specifically our son's life.
Yeah.
Because it is his life when they get that age, or even way before. I think fundamentalists may argue about when life begins, but the writer mom knows it's the moment when her child says, "Don't write about me anymore, mom." So that was very clearly in my head. No, my husband acknowledged that it was very, very sad for him as well.
We have an email here from CW who writes, "Sarah, as a teacher, I think I've seen a lot of cases of only daughters whose single moms have made them their best friend and confidant. The girl of 10 to 14 who brags, 'My mom's my best friend,' seems inevitably at 16 to 25 to be involved in a ferocious struggle to separate herself. Any words of wisdom for a single mom who is tempted to make her daughter her best friend?"
Don't do it. Don't do it.
Would that it were that simple, though, right?
Exactly. I mean, I can certainly understand. At one point, Cam is talking to her breastfeeding class and taking questions about, "Oh, my kid won't let me do this. My kid won't." And she says, "Listen, there's a reason that God gives the little people to the big people." So please do not ask me for parenting advice. I cannot begin to tell you how horrible I am at this area.
Well, I guess that's the other thing that we see throughout the book is that everybody feels that way, right? If you don't question yourself, there's probably a problem.
That thought comforts me, Chris. I don't know if it's true, but I find it deeply comforting.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We'll speak with Brian in Fort Worth. Hey, Brian.
Hi. Well, first of all, I love the definition of when life begins. I've pondered that, and just listening to the radio show, you answered that for me. But my question is overall, and I know you're getting this too, but it seems to me, maybe I'm wrong, but a lot of this has to do with the obsession and inordinate control, to me, that the modern mother relentlessly puts on and into their kiddos, you know, like, "We got to go to Texas, it's the best," and, you know, blah, 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 and this and that. And I was just wondering if you think maybe the people that really need the school might be the mothers and their obsessive tendencies and the dads and not anyone else. And I was also wondering about University of Texas. You said when only people who, and I know it was tongue-in-cheek, you know, who have designed particle accelerators in their, you know, backyards get in. And, you know, that's really a misconception because two of my daughters went there and a lot of their friends did just recently. And they were darn good students who studied hard for the SAT, didn't do anything extra, and they all got in. So I wanted to dispel.
Yeah,
that.
No.
That's good to know.
Yes, good point. You've made a very good point, and I'm just that was sour grapes.
What about the obsessive parenting of today?
Boy, I certainly saw it in that senior year. It got so intense. There was one mother who literally was weeping because both her older children had gotten into Stanford, and her senior had not gotten into Stanford. I said, "I'm not crying for you, Argentina." So it does get a bit extreme. It has gotten a bit extreme. And maybe the gap year, a real gap year, is not such a bad idea when you consider how astronomically expensive it is and what a very costly way that is for a young person to figure out what they want to do in life.
Why do you think we don't do that here in nearly the same percentages that it happens in Europe?
That's a good question. I think, you know, there's this kind of belief here, and I think it's fixed to the idea of a retirement age, which no longer exists. And also the idea that if a young person doesn't go directly into college, he or she will never go to college. Also not true. I don't know. I don't know, because they make a lot of sense, particularly for boys.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny that so many parents now are trying to keep boys back a year before they start mm-hmm. kindergarten, mm-hmm. so they'll be physically the same size or whatever. But, it would make sense to have a year of working. And I suppose, yeah, there is that sense that...
Yeah, I mean, did you know what you wanted to be when you were 18? Who does? Who knows?
Yeah, it's hard to...
But, you know, like when I was going to school, University of New Mexico was $70 tuition, and that's a cheap way to sort of figure out what you don't want to do. But now $40,000 a year that's pretty pricey.
Yeah, it's occurred to me that there's no room to fail a semester anymore. That, you know, right. I went to school with a lot of people who had a couple of rocky, you know, false starts, and then they got on their way.
Yeah, I know. And I had the luxury of exploring a lot of things that I knew would lead nowhere, and of course led nowhere, but were what college was all about.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Rob in Fort Worth. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Chris. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
Great. Yeah, I was wondering about the effect on the relationship between husband and wife and what your guests thought about that. My marriage completely fell apart when my kids left.
Interesting.
Just wondering about that. Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that. Do you have any ideas why that happened?
We discovered we disagreed about everything.
You didn't have the buffer of the children around, right?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And we didn't have exactly the buffer is the right word to use.
Right. Yeah. I know. There was one point after we dropped our son off, and I momentarily stopped weeping, and I just felt like I had walked into this vast meadow of empty mental space, because that huge overriding concern was just gone. I said, wow, I am not the number one person in charge at this moment. Hmm. So, but then, you know, into that vast, enormous amount of space was my husband. And for so long, I felt like we'd been two parts of this baby-carrying machine. And now the factory had stopped very suddenly, very, very suddenly. So I don't know. You know, I mean, that's a good point. There probably should be more written about that.
Has that extra time and extra mental space been good for you as a writer? I would think the one thing that you could always use more of is thinking time.
I think that's absolutely true, because children are very distracting. Children are very distracting. When our son was little, I realized that for me, writing a novel was kind of like solving a big equation, this big physics problem, and you had to carry it around in your head, and it all had to balance out. Both sides of the equation had to balance out. And I didn't have the mental space when he was little to do that. So for many years when he was young, I made my living writing screenplays, mm-hmm. which, you know, much smaller projects, and somebody else was giving you the ideas. But oddly enough, and this is, I don't know what this says, but it concerns me, at the roughly the same time that our son left, I got a fellowship to go out to the Dobie Paisano Ranch, which seemed just ideal, exactly what you're talking about. I don't have any distractions. Now I can just go out there. And so they asked me if I wanted internet, and I said, no, I don't want internet. I'm just going to be out there without those distractions and just think about this big project I want to work on. Then I got out there, and the first day I was there, my editor called and said, okay, Sarah, I've got all the changes for you to look at in the manuscript. I'll email them to you. And I said, it'll be a while, because it's an hour to the nearest internet cafe, free Wi-Fi place. So, you know, then I said, yeah, put the internet in. It's kind of, the internet is kind of like having six or seven children. constant distractions. So It's a Hydra-headed monster with many, many problems associated with it.
Well, and it's so easy to justify. I mean, you and I do different kinds of work, but I can tell myself that I need the internet to
Absolutely.
Research these 11 things when really four of them would have been plenty for the preparation I'm doing.
Yes, exactly. I go off and I'm now fascinated by the, you know, some things like the drug wars along the border. The best research is on the internet. But, you know, I start doing that and then suddenly, and now I have this thing, like, you know, if I'm reading an actual book, I want to click on a link and find out. So, you know, I stop reading and go look stuff up, and it's never ending. Here's my sad admission. I had to get a program called Freedom that you tell it how long it will prevent you from getting on the internet. That's where I'm at.
So basically it says for 2 hours in the morning or something, you can be online or?
Right. You know, the first step in getting help is admitting you're sick. So there it is. I'm sick.
What was it like on the ranch? Was it what you expected?
Oh, it was such a dream. It's such a dream. That's the best fellowship in the country.
You go for the summer. Is that right?
Well, they have two a year and you go for roughly 5 months and you're just out there and they pay a lovely stipend and you're in this gorgeous setting right by Barton on Barton Creek, and they had rain. This was summer before last, and they had rain, and so there was water the entire time. And let me tell you, Texas with water is a totally different thing from Texas without water.
Yeah, it's been a particularly rough year down there this year.
Oh, it's brutal. Mm-hmm. brutal.
Sarah Bird is my guest. She's a novelist and columnist. Her new book is called The Gap Year. You can meet her tonight at a Real bookstore in Fairview. The event starts with drinks at 6, and there's a book signing at 7. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist and Texas Monthly columnist Sarah Bird. Her new book is called The Gap Year. If you'd like to meet her, she will appear tonight at a Real bookstore in Fairview, Texas. Drinks start at 6. There's a signing at 7. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we go to Cindy in Grandview. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. We raised four daughters and sent them all off to college, and we cried and we got over it and got happy. But last week, one told me she has been accepted to a medical school and will be going down to the island of Dominica near Venezuela.
Ooh,
wow.
And
nice.
I'm in full-out panic mode.
You're in full-out panic mode.
Oh. I mean, I've been on the State Department's website checking out all the country and stuff, and I was just wondering if you had any words of wisdom for out-of-country students.
I was, you know, I went through a serious separation. So this isn't going to comfort you, but I certainly lived through it. At the age of 20, I got a year rail pass and backpacked around Europe for a year and a half.
So Cindy should call your mom.
Yeah. And this was in the days before cell phones. I mean, you have cell phones now. Nobody is really that out of touch, are they?
You know, what's fascinating about all these calls we're getting, one is it's for men as well as women.
I love that.
And you mentioned that online men have been reading the book, which is not to say that this is a woman's book and it's certainly not chick lit. But were you surprised at as many fathers picking this up as mothers?
Very surprised. And pleased. Mm-hmm. Pleased. I think that's one of the big unacknowledged things about this. As much as the sadness is unacknowledged for mothers, much more so for men.
It would be an interesting book to read too.
Yeah, and I've known lots of fathers who are devastated when their children leave, and also not allowed to express it as much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is the first generation of dads that changed diapers and
right.
was involved and dropped off at preschool,
yes.
and yet suddenly they're supposed to be very stoic when it's all over.
Exactly. And, you know, go get 'em, Tiger. And I don't know, that doesn't seem emotionally true to me.
Is it hard for you now that everybody looks to you and says, do you have any, we've had so many calls, people wanting advice.
Oh, God, I just have to, you know, put out a giant disclaimer. I'm a novelist, guys. You know, I did research it a lot. But honestly, you can get better advice from whoever you sit next to on the bus.
How does it work for you when you're writing a story that has emotional truth to it, but you've fictionalized the details and sort of given people lives that just come out of your head? There's so many possibilities. You could go in 1,000 directions.
Yes and no. I think my belief about characters is, you know, the way you can clone something from a fingernail paring. That's what you do with a character and the entire character. Once you start on a character, everything has to be true to your very first inkling of that character, you know, unless that, you know, however you change him, it all has to be coherent. It has to hang together. So there are kind of 1,000 ways to go, and there are kind of not 1,000 ways to go. Creating the character of the football player, I started off on him, and he was going to be pretty much a generic football player. I just needed him to be whoever mom would hate the most.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to create him, and he came to life in very, very specific ways and told me he was not going to follow my stereotypes that I had set out for him.
He's interesting, too, because we don't find out everything. He's got kind of a dark, mysterious past. And mm-hmm. he seems like a genuinely decent person, but we don't know exactly what's gone on there.
Yeah. And you really won't find out until the end of the book. But that's just true in life. Everybody, if you let them, everybody will surprise you. Nobody's who you think they are. And that, I guess, ultimately, that's the big gap in the gap year and you know, being able to tell both sides of the story, the mother's story and the daughter's story. And growing out of my ferocious hunger to know what was going on in our son's head after he separated and then telling both sides of their story and realizing the mother's story and the daughter's story are told on parallel tracks and they will never intersect.
Hmm. Maybe the daughter will someday write a book and
No. I mean, just in the sense that we do have these little humans and we're so close and so intimate with them and then it ends
mm-hmm.
the way you will never, you know, that you don't know your mate, that you just don't know. That's what we have novels for, the only way to really know people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Maggie in Fort Worth. Hey, Maggie.
Hi. I think your conversation earlier about breastfeeding and the process, and I would bring into that weaning, has a lot to do with this. I don't consider myself an unnatural mother, and I'm not heartbroken that my children are now both away in college. When they were young, they nursed until they were ready to stop. Each of them was about 2.5. And it was very, you know, the last couple of years was probably just evening and morning and nap time. When they were ready to stop, it was clear. And then I handed them off to their father to read them at bedtime, and they didn't expect to nurse anymore. And I think you learn you can't make mm-hmm. them nurse when they don't want to anymore. And that correlation goes along with when they get ready to go to college, don't you?
Well, that sounds like a very, you had a very, very smooth transition in both cases. And, you know, mazel tov, my friend.
Do you have a pattern on the days that you're writing? Do you get up at a certain hour and sit down at a certain time? And how does that work for you?
It really depends what I'm working on. I'm not an everyday kind of writer, and I work a lot in my head. I work a lot laying in bed and greatest thing that anyone ever told me about writing was my father. And he didn't tell me this about writing, but whenever I had problems and I thought were insoluble, he'd always say, let it marinate in the subconscious. And honest to God, it's just you go to sleep and wake up and have the answer. So maybe that's where I do. I get all my best ideas from the pillow and shower and the steering wheel. Those are where all my best ideas come from.
Which is interesting because those are times when you can't really be doing much else besides thinking. And
yeah, you disengage and you go into, what is it, your beta state, go into a beta state. So this is good. I remember reading once Joan Didion, whenever she was stuck on something, would drive the freeways late at night. I understand that. Driving is good.
It must surprise you, or I guess I suppose it doesn't surprise you anymore, but it surprises me, having talked to a lot of writers, how very individual the process is for different people. There are people who say, I hate everything about sitting down to write. It's excruciating. Other people say, once I'm going, it just flows through me. Do you enjoy talking to other writers, do you marvel at how different their experiences are?
You know, I didn't really come out of a writing program, and I've always felt a little intimidated that I never quite learned the language of writing programs, and I don't really know how to talk about the process in the way a lot of writers talk about it. So, but I would say more than different ways of writing, I think different books kind of require different ways of writing, and every book has been different for me. I remember when I was writing Flamenco Academy, which is has lots of different time changes and historical periods in it, I started the day by working crossword puzzles because I needed to get much more cerebral than I did for my other books because I had a lot of problems, intellectual problems to figure out. And Yakota Officers Club was, I was like Voltaire in bed with my nightcap the whole time writing that book, and it came out of dreams and characters whispering to me and little memories that I would just write down, and I don't know why I'm writing this down, but it eventually added up.
So that's interesting because Wally Lamb, the novelist, has said every time he finishes a book and he's ready to start another one, he thinks he doesn't know how to write a book.
Yeah.
Which kind of sounds like what you're describing. It's a totally different process.
I think the only thing that's different is that I have faith now, where I didn't have faith. I know that the subconscious will marinate it. Whatever that little chip I have in my brain is going to make a story happen. So I just, I guess I'm not as anxiety-ridden about it as I used to be.
Do you write short fiction at all?
Only columns and essays. That it's just sort of a form I never learned. And it's the predominant form taught in colleges, you know, a Masters of Fine Arts program, mostly because it's handleable.
The professor can read it. And
right, yeah. And it's hard to help someone with a novel because so much about a novel is structure, and you have to You have to be able to look at the bones of a book, and it's that can, I mean, I can understand why it's hard to teach a novel in college.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Anne in Dallas. Hi, Anne.
Hi. How are you this morning?
Great, thank you.
You're talking to Sarah, who is one of my all-time favorite writers.
Well,
I had
great.
The
you.
Pleasure of meeting her at the Jackson Hole Writers Conference a few years back.
Oh, that was fun.
And I'm glad that you are talking about The Gap, the Gap Year. I can hardly wait to read that. I want you to know that I went through all of that with three children, sending them off to school. Now they're all married and have their own kids. And every time I leave them, I still have that sinking feeling of, oh, my goodness, you know, I'm losing my baby again. So I think it's just inbred in our mother genes.
I think, you know, that's what I'm saying. It's a physical thing, but it's a bittersweet feeling, and especially in your case where, you're leaving them in a happy place, and good for you.
Does any of this explain for you the lust that people have at a certain point in their kids' lives for grandchildren?
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, God, to have one of these little, you know, the first luxury good must have been a baby. Get this little thing. It smells so good. They feel so good. You can put your nose in their mouth. They just love you. And their breast smells like caramel. Ooh, who wouldn't want that?
So we talked about technology and it sort of creeping into everybody's lives. Does it bother you that people will read this book on a little machine?
Not in the least. I love those machines. I don't own one, but hallelujah for the e-reader. Because what they've done that I'm so grateful for is they've made books into an impulse buy.
Mm-hmm.
That
actually a really dangerous impulse buy.
I can speak
from experience.
Thank you. You know, honestly, I don't. So many of the books I read are bizarre. They will never be on ebook readers. But you know, eventually, the next big trip I go on, I'm sure I'll get one. But you know, people go, oh, for $9.99, I'll pay that to put it on my list. So, mm-hmm. yay! And I'm actually looking forward to reading my first book on a Kindle and seeing what that experience is like.
It's nice if you're lying on your side because you don't have to keep flipping the book.
There you go.
In the same position.
There you go. And also, some books are too damn heavy.
Mm-hmm.
Then they make my wrists hurt.
So how do you decide? Do you sort of feel like you float from one project to another? Is it something that's always in the back of your mind? And you mentioned several times this hour writing things down. I mean, do you keep a list of what you want to write about?
I don't keep a list, and I discovered that was kind of wrong for me because if I write something down, I get invested in it. I'm quite a frugal gal, and I don't like things to go to waste. And I find that if I don't write things down, and if I have an idea and it floats to the surface again and again, I go, that's an idea worth looking at, because writing a novel is such a huge investment emotionally and time-wise. So I have to care a great deal about it. And that's, I guess, my own automatic winnowing process. If an idea keeps coming back, and I also find that I'll get an idea and I don't quite know where it fits. And then it's like a couple years go by and the other piece comes and they you know, somehow mate and boom, things happen. It gets spicy.
How has your relationship, not personal relationship, but your relationship to the process of being edited changed over time and over several novels?
I am extremely fortunate. I have a wonderful, wonderful editor, wonderful, wonderful publisher, Knopf. It was just wonderful from day one and it hasn't changed. So I've actually been very lucky with all my editors. At Texas Monthly, I was very, very privileged to have Evan Smith as my editor. It's hard editing humor, and he was superb.
Which is funny because he's a very straight-laced guy.
You know, he's got a lot going on in his head, but he's not. If he's not doing a million things, he's not at all straight-laced. But, you know, I mean, he's an on-task guy. But very, very smart editor, you know, great sense of humor. He wrote just some of the greatest cut lines for my pieces ever. I mean, he's very funny.
Well, Sarah Bird, thank you so much for spending this hour with us. I really, really appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. This was fun.
The new novel is called The Gap Year. You can meet Sarah Bird tonight in person at A Real Bookstore in Fairview, Texas. Drinks will be served at 6. The book signing starts at 7. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.